From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Labor was hoping to put the Morrison government on the spot this week over climate policy after Joe Biden's win signalled a coming shift in the United States approach. Instead, it was Labor that found itself on the back foot when its resources spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon quit the front bench and ramped up his long-running campaign to have Labor move its climate and energy policies more to the political centre. With Labor for months openly divided over climate policy and Anthony Albanese struggling to get general cut-through during COVID, the Fitzgibbon exit to the backbench inevitably led to some chatter about leadership. But at least for the moment, Albanese's position appears secure. Today, Joel Fitzgibbon joins us to talk about his decision, about climate policy and the positioning of the Labor Party more generally, as well as about the future of the leadership. Joel Fitzgibbon, can you just clarify the events immediately before you're leaving the front bench? You and your leader had words at Shadow Cabinet the night before, and many colleagues were angry at your weekend warning that the United States result shouldn't be seen as a vindication of those who want to set Australia on a path to slower economic growth by tougher climate action. You said that Anthony Albanese knew you intended to leave the front bench before Christmas, but in the heat of the moment, did Albanese tell you on Tuesday morning to go now, or was that your choice, the timing?
No, he did not. I told Anthony Albanese in the immediate days, the days immediately after the election, once the front bench positions had been established, that I intended to only stick around maybe for 18 months and make way for Hughesy to come back. In other words, I'd given myself 18 months to give momentum to what I call the project of bringing the party back to what I describe as the sensible centre. And I'd set a date roughly in the last week of the sittings this year, maybe the 7th of December, I thought would be appropriate, give the party time to find a new front bencher before we go home for Christmas. And I went to see Anthony Albanese on budget night after Josh Frydenberg delivered the budget. We had a couple of beers and a Chinese takeaway feed, and I reminded him then, not that I suspect he needed reminding, that 18 months ago I'd told him, or thereabouts, I'd told him that I wouldn't be sticking around, and I reaffirmed my intention to leave. Didn't put a date on it, but sometime, you know, roughly before Christmas. Now, the dust-up on Monday night that we never acknowledged happened because it's Shadow Cabinet was a significant one, and I instinctively thought, well, maybe now is the time to do it. What's the difference between now and the first or second week in December, or the first week in December, actually? And I walked in to see him on Tuesday morning, and I told him that now is the time and I'd be moving on.
So he definitely didn't initiate the go now?
He did not initiate anything, no.
Now, why do you think you can get policy change more effectively from the back bench rather than remaining within the tent?
Well, axiomatically, I wasn't really keen on rejoining the front bench after the election, but I thought if I was going to develop my project, I'll keep calling it, to the point where it has some momentum, then I'd need to be doing it from the front bench. I think now I'm confident that I can continue to push that momentum from the back bench, remembering that it was my decision to go 18 months earlier. And, you know, I am keen to relieve myself of the very, very hefty responsibilities of a senior Shadow Cabinet position to redouble my efforts in my electorate.
Now, you refer to the project. Can you tell us exactly what you think in terms of Labor's climate policy? Maybe the project's wider than that, but just confining to climate policy, what should that be?
A meaningful climate change policy, but one that doesn't open us up to a scare campaign, which we've been subjected to in the past, and one that does no more than is necessary to satisfy our international partners that we are carrying our fair share of the burden. Now, given we're 1.3% of global emissions, obviously that burden doesn't need to be a particularly hefty one. Talk of medium-term targets at 45% reduction like we did last time is both unnecessary and, in my view, and it's proven to be a political suicide.
So what should it be?
I think we should be sitting on the government. I think we spend too much time being a government in exile. This is a moving feast. The government has to go to, is it Glasgow next year, for the meeting of the parties, the Council of the Parties, and we should wait and see. Now, Scott Morrison has used the cover of COVID to spend up. Yeah, he's in a happy position at the moment of being able to run up as much debt and spend what he likes without any significant criticism from the business community or even the most cautious economists. So he's going down this path of investing and encouraging or leveraging investment in the sort of technologies that could play a very significant role. So let him do that for a couple of years. If he's serious about it, he will be somewhat advanced in that approach. And my view is that if he's advanced in that approach, we should stick with the technology approach rather than going back to a carbon constraint.
That is an emissions trading scheme or something
that puts a price on carbon, which is deliberately intended to make it more difficult for fossil fuel generation.
So do you think that Labor should match the government's targets rather than setting its own?
Well, I still believe that to be the case. They are the government. One of the consequences of losing elections is that you don't get to be the government, and the government of the day gets to set the targets and determine how it meets its obligations or its commitments to those targets. So let the government government. I made the point right back in, what was it, nearly 18 months ago now, thank you, when, I said, if we just allowed the government to govern, then they might be held to account by the community with respect to whether they're meeting their commitments. But we always make ourselves the target. So instead of people thinking about their inability or unlikely capacity to meet their target, they're talking about Labor and what Labor is intending to do, or more particularly giving Scott Morrison a chance to start a conversation about Labor.
Now, I notice you've emphasised that you agree with the ambition of net zero emissions by 2050. Is this the same as endorsing that as a target, which is Labor's policy?
Yeah, look, I'm comfortable to describe it as a target. It's a little bit like weight loss, isn't it? If you want to lose 6 kilos, you set yourself a target and it helps to motivate you to get there. But equally, many people can get there without having a target or being focused on the target or weighing themselves every day. And we tend to weigh ourselves every day in this debate, which is silly because, as I've said many times, the path to net zero emissions will not be linear. You don't have to be halfway there at the halfway point because new technologies will make it much easier into the future. So if I want to take 200 megatons of carbon out of the atmosphere, does it matter whether I do it by closing down a generator or capturing the carbon from the generator? Now, some people with an ideological view on this say, oh, there's a big difference. You can't keep taking fossil fuels out of the ground. That's a terrible thing. I believe if you reduce by 200 tons by any means, then it's the same outcome and we should be all happy with that. Now, if a technology comes, it's theoretically possible that a technology could arrive in 2030, which makes it dramatically easier to reduce carbon output. And this is what I mean when I say you don't have to be halfway at the halfway point, halfway in your achievement at the halfway point.
You sound in a way as though you would like climate policy, energy policy, to be a bipartisan area rather than an area of partisan competition, which is what it's been, or certainly what it was at the last election.
That's right. The best way to get an outcome is to settle the climate wars, to get the major parties together, singing from the same hymn sheet. The problem there, of course, is that many in the fringe left of the Labor Party want it to continue to be an issue because they think it's a political advantage over their opponents. And maybe it is in some progressive seats in Melbourne or inner Sydney or wherever. And of course, the Liberal Party and the National Parties, they don't want it to end because they've already milked at least two elections out of it. So why would they want the climate change wars to end? And by the way, I think that's the view of the Greens too. What is the Greens Party without climate change? I mean, what would they fundraise on? What would they campaign on if it wasn't for climate change? If everyone just said, oh, we'll just all agree now. So I think that we do need a political settlement, and it's a shame that we're not sufficiently mature to get one.
Now, Ed Husic is replacing you as resources spokesman for the moment, but that may not be a long-term position for him because Anthony Albanese has indicated he is looking at a reshuffle at the end of the year. If there is a reshuffle, do you think it would be useful for this debate within the Labor Party if climate spokesman Mark Butler was moved?
Look, I've been very careful not to talk about personalities, but
Say if there was a new climate spokesman.
I think a refresh in that area would be good. I think that Mark's become a warrior of the climate change debate, and I think someone without his history, someone that doesn't bring baggage, if you like, to the conversation, might be better placed to prosecute Labor's case in the broader electorate. I mean, Mark was there when we had a 45% reduction target. Now, you say something once, it tends to stick with you. So someone new in that space and someone who has developed more trust with the business community, for example, might be a better place to sell a policy.
Any ideas?
No, I haven't given that thought.
Now, the Shadow Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, was fairly outspoken this morning, and he said that a large majority in Labor and also in the general community would disagree with your climate policy views. What's your response to Mark Dreyfus?
Well, of course, a lot of people in the Labor Party and in the broader community would disagree with my views. If the broader community was unanimous in its view about climate change, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But I think what he was trying to do was imply that I'm in the minority. Well, I don't know what polling or research or data he's relying upon to come to that conclusion, but Mark Dreyfus, I suspect, has never been in working class heartland where I live, and I think if he came to visit, he's very welcome, I think he'd maybe see a different attitude.
Now, Labor for years has had to juggle these constituencies of inner-city progressives and traditional working-class voters, and the climate issue has just made this harder. You've suggested that Labor can have different messages for different localities, but didn't it do that last time, and wasn't that part of its problem?
No, we didn't do that last time. Labor maintained a very strict discipline on its candidates. Our candidate in Flynn, for example, probably would have done much better and maybe would have won the seat if he'd been allowed to say what he really thought about the Adani coal mine. But he stayed loyal to the party and followed direction. I'm not suggesting that you have a rabble where every candidate and every member and every senator is an independent unit. But the reality is if you don't start allowing candidates and local members to be a better voice for their local communities, to better reflect their communities, then you're going to lose and not pick up seats.
But Bill Shorten, for example, was criticised for saying one thing in the north and something else in the south.
I don't recall that. Was that the gas pipeline, maybe? I don't recall that.
Adani, mostly.
Yeah, he was accused during the Batman by-election of doing something like that, but it actually wasn't true. I think what he was guilty of, if I can use that word, because I have enormous respect for Bill, I thought he was guilty of talking too much to Batman and not talking enough to regional areas.
Now, you're arguing the Labor Party's gone too far from its working class base, but apart from climate policy, what other adjustments does it need to make to appeal to that base?
Talk about them, talk to them, visit them. Reassure them that we're with them. Now, coal miners, for example, feel demonised these days. They don't feel valued. They're told constantly, not necessarily by the Labor Party, but certainly told by others, that their industry shouldn't be there. Their industry has no merit. Now, they're very proud of being coal miners. They think they're doing something for the country. They're earning big export dollars. to pay for all those imports so much enjoy. So the Labor Party needs to be telling them that they're with them, they're on their side, they respect what they do for the country. You know, in times of war, you know, they are part of the war effort. Now, people talk about a transition. Coal miners are in transition themselves. They know that thermal coal, for example, while I think it's going to be around for 30 years, they don't think it'll be around for 40. Now, if you're a 30-year-old coal miner, you've got a wife and a couple of kids and a big mortgage, you want up to 30 more years out of that industry. And along the way, you want to earn enough money both to pay your mortgage and give your kids a good education, because guess what? Very few of them want their kids working in coal mines. They want them to go and do something else. So they are driving the transition themselves in that sense. But, you know, I spoke to coal miners during the election campaign, of course, as I always do, and I raised with them the issue of same rate, same pay. This is this growth of labour hire companies in the coal mining industry where you have, you know, two miners working alongside one another, one on different pay rates, because one's working for BHP and one's working for the labour hire company. And I've been campaigning on this issue, and they just looked at me and said, well, you know, we're not happy about that, but at least I still have a job. And they were, you know, they honestly believed that the Labor Party was going to close down the coal mining industry. Now, we had no such plans, but as I've said many times, if you open yourself to a scare campaign, that's what you can expect. And we have to be smarter than that. We are a party with a proud and rich and long history, and we should be smarter than that.
Now, of course, you had a bad swing in your New South Wales seat of Hunter, which is a coal seat. Do you think you have reassured your coal miners now, at least of your position? You say you're going to run again. Are you confident of holding that seat, which I think is now on a 3% margin or so, which is not a bad margin, I guess?
Yeah, there are a few people around this place who would like to have a 3% margin. And I am always keen to remind people that I was on a 3.8% margin after the 2013 election. And at the 16 election, it went back to 12.5%. And I would fully expect and hope that it will do something similar this time. I believe if they didn't get me last time, they never will. It was a perfect storm for me. And the vote didn't go to the coalition parties. In fact, the National Party vote went backwards. They lodged it as a protest vote with One Nation. So I think that the fact that I've acknowledged their concern, I've spoken on their behalf, I think they'll probably say, well, he's learnt the lesson and it's time to go back to him.
Now, you've said in this present upheaval that you're not trying to destabilise Anthony Albanese, but I guess that the old hands around the place do remember that you caused quite a storm in 2013 when you wanted Julia Gillard replaced by Kevin Rudd. Isn't the inevitable result of your actions this week that you've made things more difficult for Albanese?
Well, there's never a right time to leave, is there, Michelle? I think no matter when I announced that I was leaving the front bench, which I planned to do since soon after the last
Christmas
election.
Christmas Eve prep?
Yeah, well, that's what I had intended to do. But I think if you went to Anthony Albanese and you... if you'd gone to him that morning before I arrived in his office to declare I was going and asked him whether he prefer Fitzgibbon to wait till December or go now, he probably would have said go now. So... that is my strong instinct. I could be wrong. Maybe he might have had a think about the cycle and you know, I know I'd like you to wait. But given the size of the dust-up, oops, did I just admit there was one? You know, I think he probably would have said, yeah, good.
Secret is safe for our podcast.
He probably would have said, I love you, mate, but yeah, it's probably a good thing if you just go now and don't come back to Shadow Cabinet.
So how would you rate the odds of Albanese leading to the election?
Yeah, pretty good. I still believe that Albo... What am I trying to do? I'm trying to get people who take a very ambitious approach to climate change... and in some kind, sometimes an ideological or even theological approach, to just be patient, sit back, and accept a policy that is just a little bit better than the other mob. You know, we don't have to be 10 times better than the other mob. I mean, these people, you know, they're all going to vote for us or the Greens, and if they go to the Greens, most of it comes back to us anyway. So I ask them, you know, I'm trying to get them to be patient and to understand that it has cost us dearly at previous elections, and it will cost us again if we're not smart about it. So who is the best place, given most of those people are in the left of the party, not all, of course, as you know, who's the best placed person to bring them back, to settle them down, to persuade them that we need a more ambitious approach? And ALBA has done that to an extent already by backing gas, reaffirming our commitment to coal exports. So he started that process. You know, he deserves some time to continue that to continue his work, and he's making progress. And if he can get there, well, he'll make it to the election, and that's what I want. You know, no one wants the revolving door again. I mean, and all the drama and demis that does to the party brand. So you know, I've still got his back. I want him to succeed.
If it became clear, say, by mid next year that Labor was going to head to a really bad defeat, would you be willing to do what you did in 2013 and try and get a leadership change?
I'm just going to answer that by saying, by posing the question, what did I do in 2013? I saved Labor 10 seats. Not my assessment, but the assessment of George Wright, who, of course, delivered the traditional...
This is... By the change to Kevin Rudd.
Back to Kevin Rudd, yeah. So.
And you'd be willing to do the same thing?
I think senior people in the party have a responsibility to ensure that the party doesn't go over the proverbial cliff. And none of us are as big or bigger than the party itself. The party has to be the key interest and its capacity to win government, because millions of people are relying upon us to be a government from time to time. And we owe it to them to be electable.
Sounds like a warning.
It's just common sense, but I reaffirm my ongoing support for Anthony Albanese.
Joel Fitzgibbon, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. And that's all for this episode. My thanks to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.